Hey, welcome to Siren Radio. You're listening to Steve Court here on Word Perfect, and you're going to listen to another fantastic show where we speak to one of the amazing writers who is part of the Impspired world. And we're going to be joined today by Michael Lee Johnson from Illinois over in the United States, a fantastic writer who's done some incredible stuff. If you just indulge me for a second while I run through some numbers for you, but he's been published in 40 countries. He's been in over 1,098 publications. He's an editor and publisher for about 10 different sites. He's also the editor-in-chief for a string of anthologies. So this is a guy who really knows his stuff and has got his finger in many, many literary pies. So we're going to speak to him today. We're going to find out a little bit about what makes him tick, a little bit about his background, and a little bit about what he's currently working on. So Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Dave.
It's a pleasure to have you here. So, and for those people sitting at home, I know I've just given you a little rundown in numbers, but tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh boy. Actually, I come from a very common background. My father was a welder. My mother worked in the kitchen of a hospital. So I came from a very blue-collar community. I'm lucky that my parents had a great education. By the way, we'll probably be hearing my little bird, Kipper Lee, flying all over the place, but nevertheless. So, when I went to high school, I was very active in athletics, but the reality is I was flunking my courses. I just barely got out of high school. I was at the bottom one-fourth of my class. But I decided after getting a lady pregnant that we had to up our act. So I applied for getting into the back door of Bethel College in Mishawaka, Indiana, with very inferior grades, but they were not accredited at the time. So they let me in on probation. I did well, and the rest is history. And I've been to six or seven universities since. I don't know what else you want to know, Steve.
No, that's brilliant. So you've been to six, seven universities. So is that doing different degrees at each of them then? Or?
Oh, don't I wish, Steve. Give me a break. the bottom line is, how do I say this? I personally think that the American school system is so simple and so easy to contrive and to manipulate. I find it rather boring. But I didn't know that back in the day. So I went to, I took a few courses here, a few courses there, year here, year there, and whatever, and amalgamated a whole bunch of undirected courses. So when I ended up in Canada, which you can ask about later, then I was under the English school system, and things changed because they are much more strict. When I went to Canada and I tried to have credits accepted, I ended up graduating with a three-year degree at Lethbridge University, but I had probably 6 years of coursework in the undergraduate level before I went on to work on a master's. Long story made short, I showed up two courses short of a master's. I started a PhD. I finished three courses and I quit. I was bored.
It's an interesting background. So you stayed in education for quite a long time then. So was that within a creative subject?
No, I actually, young, I believe this, Steve. I feel like you're almost my next door neighbor and you're in England. What the hell's going on with this? But anyway, the bottom line is, while I was at Lethbridge University in Lethbridge, Alberta, I actually took a creative writing course, pass or fail. And I failed. Out of about 25 people, I was the only one who failed, which is sort of interesting.
It is interesting, especially when you then see what you go on to do. And to give you a similarity, we were saying before about how we've got kind of a similar approach to things and a similar background. My lowest GCSE score, which are kind of like our high school things, was actually my English literature grade.
Well, you know what, though, to be honest, though, this touches into something later by Christine. But the bottom line is that when I entered under probation at Bethel College in Mishawaka, Indiana, I was horrified by the fact. By the way, English was my worst subject. I was horrified by the fact of getting a written and oral communication class where I had to stand up in front of people and do my thing. Bottom line is I was petrified. Surprisingly, I got through with it with a C minus and I felt better about my life.
You started off with that kind of creative writing desire, even if the grades didn't necessarily kick in. Did you carry on writing at that point as well, even when you failed that course?
Well, what happened, of course, I got a lady pregnant. We had a child and so forth. So the scenario was slightly different. I got into Bethel College by the back end door. That marriage didn't last, which is quite common when it's 16, 17 years of age. But somewhere along the line in that transition, going from Bethel College to Marion College and Marion, Indiana, whatever, I eventually started to pick up because the Vietnam War was starting to heat up. Bottom line is, in 1968, I started to write what I considered to be poetry. I was at a restaurant in Marion, Indiana, and the guy next to me, I was at a restaurant. I had to go to restaurants to look at all the cutie waitresses. Anyway, I had my books and stuff, and I had them collapsed, you know, around me and so forth. And the guy next to me says, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I sort of write poetry. I try to." He said, "Well, why don't you share it with me?" And I said, "Because I don't want to, because it's private." He said, "You know what? You're a very selfish person." He said, "When you learn to share your poetry, I'd like to talk to you some more." That was a very eye-opening experience for me.
That feeling of needing to share something. Yeah, I think that's it's a big step for a lot of writers, though, isn't it? A lot of writers get trapped inside the process of writing and that it becomes something very personal to them. And actually, that idea of somebody else even reading it is huge.
Well, I think where it really comes from, and it's just my personal opinion of having a social work background and so forth, I actually think it comes from poets' basic insecurities, where they try to find and work their way out of their own hell sometimes. And if they can finally work their way out of their hell, instead of finding poetry being depressive, they can actually find poetry being life fulfilling and enriching to the point where they can live a constructive life. But it takes a journey sometimes to get there.
Absolutely, yeah. So what was it that finally broke your cycle then and let you start to share things?
That experience. I at that point, I started to save the poems. I started to type them up on old hand, fingertip typing, whatever the hell. I eventually ended up with a Smith Corona Electric 2210, whatever. And then I'd rip them out of there and I'd throw them away. And then I just keep it in a whatever, you know, but this is pre-Vietnam, pre-Canada.
Yeah.
1968, yeah. And I left the United States in May of 1970 for 10 years, and I came back to the United States in May of, 1980? Yes.
Yeah, so about 10 years away. So what was it, the Vietnam War itself then? Is that the catalyst that prompted your move to Canada? Or?
Oh, absolutely. You know, you have to be careful how you state these things, all right? Even now, 50 years later, you have to be a little bit careful. But, you know, the bottom line is that I was at Andrews University in Berrien Springs, Michigan, the Seventh-day Adventist school. And I was doing okay. I was getting my B's and so forth. But I ended up with a two-year language requirement in French or whatever, parlez-vous français, you know, that I just couldn't catch on to at the time. So I knew I was going to come up short. I was not going to graduate. Then a couple of incidents in my life, which I don't want to go into detail about, popped up. And at that point, even though I'd been thinking about for a couple of years, and I even knew I wanted to go to Waterloo, Ontario, and Kitchener, something hit, and I just had to pack in 20, 30 minutes and get the hell out. On my way to Canada.
Real quick move up to Canada then. So what was then the alternative catalyst? What was it that drove you to come back to the United States?
Difficult question, but to make it really brief, after 9 or 8 years in exile, President Carter, God bless his heart, he's still alive, granted, Ford, President Ford in the United States granted conditional amnesty. You could come back, but you'd have to work 2 years of civil service, et cetera, to work off your, quote, debt to society. I didn't buy into that because I never felt the Vietnam War was legitimate, and I still don't to this day, even though I have changed and I respect Vietnam veterans greatly. But the bottom line is Jimmy Carter came into office and offered unconditional amnesty for all Vietnam War resistors. But even then, I waited another year or two before I came back because, I don't know, I had to go through a long process of sending notifications and letters or whatever to the American consulate in Calgary, and that they couldn't find me because I was drifting around going to too many different apartments in Edmonton, Alberta. But he eventually found me. Said, "You know what? You've been granted amnesty. All you have to do is come down here and pledge allegiance to the United States as a dual citizen." and you can do what you want.
Okay, well, it's an interesting thing. I think you touched on something there that a lot of people have struggled with, which is being opposed to a war, but being able to be pro-veterans. Because you appreciate the difference between the people being sent to fight it and the people choosing for it to exist in the first place.
I can now at 73 years of age, and probably did about 5 years ago, but I went to Niles High School in Niles, Michigan. And many of my classmates, I was pretty close. I wasn't in the upper end of class because I wasn't really intelligent, but they couldn't ignore me because I was really good in athletics. But the bottom line is, now that I go to a website from Niles, Michigan, my school website on Facebook, there are still some people there that resent me after 50 years. But my response to that is, privately, between you and I and the rest of the world that listens to this, get over it. We're all going to die, all right? There's not much time left. But I also learned by listening to those things and listening to the struggles that Vietnam veterans have coming back that, they didn't have no more choice than I did. We all lost. The American public lost. Vietnam veterans lost. Vietnam draft dodgers and deserters lost. Nobody won in that war.
Yeah, it's a quite a unique thing that's like you say that 50 years on you can still be having these impacts from it in the US. So it's a really interesting thing to talk about. But it must have fueled a lot of writing for you. That experience, that feeling the need to leave your country, feeling the need to object to something so strongly. So did that come out in the poetry you were writing?
Oh, absolutely. I remember some of the first poems I wrote, Stephen. I can't share them here because I'm not like some of these real smart people that can memorize all their poetry on the poetry slams, But I can remember simple-minded poetry I wrote about cabins in wilderness lands in 1967, 68, about the potential dream of going to some cabin up in the wilderness, way to hell up and just be left alone. So yes, there were many poems. And ironically, after I got up there, I wrote many poems about Canada. I wrote many poems about Vietnam War resistance, and it still has an impact on my life.
So a real kind of shaping experience.
Absolutely.
And what then inspires you now? When you sit down to write now, what is it that makes you want to pick up a pen?
I don't know. Maybe insanity. Maybe a few shots of vodka. Who the hell knows? I was a rebel at one point. I think that's pretty obvious. But as I've gotten older, I've become much more conservative in my views politically, socially, financially, putting in a few props to give some stability to my life. But there's 15% of me, Steve, that will always be a damn rebel. That's probably where some of it comes from.
And I think if you look at probably half of the poets on the planet, you'll find that need to be different, or that need to do something different, or to have an opinion and to voice it. That's a huge thing for them. And talking of having a voice and voicing it, do you have any of your work that you could share with us?
Well, let me look here. What I'm sort of enjoying this. I'm pretty good at these impromptu damn things. Hold on here just a minute. You know what? Because if you're not real, you're a fake, and there's nothing good about being a fake. Hold on, Steve. I just pulled up one. It's actually a fairly recent poem, and it's called Flower Girl. And it does have a YouTube video associate, but it goes, Flower Girl, Tears in Your Eyes, poem by Michael Lee Johnson. Poems are hard to create. They live, then die, walk alone in tears, resurrect in family mausoleums. They walk with you alone in ghostly patterns, memories they deliver, feelings unexpectedly, through the open windows of strangers. Silk roses lie in a potted bowl, memories 7 days before Mother's Day. Soak those tears, patience is the poetry of love. Plant your memories, your seeds, your passion once a year, maybe twice. Jesus knows we all need more than a vase filled with silk flowers. Poems on paper from a poet sacred. The mystery, the love of a caretaker. Multicolored silk flowers in a basket handed out by the flower girl. That's it.
That's it. Thank you very much for that. And you say that that's on a YouTube video, because I think you've got quite a lot of your pieces recorded, haven't you?
224 videos are now published on YouTube.
I knew it was quite a lot. That is a lot. And how would people find that if they wanted to go and listen to some more?
Oh, that's simple. Just all you have to do is just, you know, I've got such a common name, Steve. I'm going to cuss my father till the day I die. Michael Lee Johnson. How boring. Michael Johnson. That's even worse. All right. My dad wanted to call me, what the hell was it? Barney-o or something, you know, but thank God my mother quit that. The bottom line is, because I'm just Michael Johnson, I just said, you got to have the middle name in there. Michael Lee Johnson, poetry. Itasca, Illinois or Illinois. I'll tell you what, if you just type Michael Lee Johnson poetry, yeah, it's going to come up everywhere.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's brilliant. So people can go to YouTube and look for Michael Lee Johnson if you want to listen to some more of his work on there. So
thank you, Steve. Thank you.
We come to the point in the show when we're going to have our first musical break. And we are going to pick up a Leonard Cohen song in a second. We're going to have So Long, Marianne. But I know that you've met the man twice, I think, wasn't it?
Yes.
So I wanted to have a quick chat to you about that first, because that's very exciting.
Okay.
So when did you first meet him?
I met Leonard Cohen the first time in Edmonton, Alberta, one of his songfests. The second time I met Leonard Cohen, when I was actually with a quote wife in Montreal, I met him there. Ran in Quebec City in a local restaurant, not being able to speak French. And Leonard Cohen sitting in that restaurant. You know, he actually lived in a near community near Montreal. I just can't think of the name of right this moment. In fact, I was just looking it up the other day. It's about 10 miles from someplace, a suburb of Montreal. So that was really interesting. But at the time, he didn't really know who I was, didn't really care, but I knew who the hell he was. And I went up and introduced myself and I said, I really appreciate your work. And I've loved him to this day. And he's the biggest, Carl Sandburg is actually the biggest influence on my life, but Leonard Cohen is the second biggest influence on my life, because I just love the romanticism, the imagery, and so forth. That's all.
And he was very clever as a poet to realize that music was where the money was going to lie for him, wasn't he?
Smarter than I am.
That's what I always think. If only I could sing or play an instrument. Because I was looking at it, I think he had a 52-year poetry career between his first release and his last one. And he had a 52-year music career between his first release and his last one. And he brought
more poetry. I don't know if it was that long, Steve. I couldn't be correct in this, right? I think he died in California about 3 or 4 years ago. And I think he died at 81 or 83.
Yeah. From his first release of his first book to his last release of a book, it was 52 years. Not that he lived longer than that.
Actually, that's probably pretty accurate when I think about it.
But he released more poetry books than he did release music albums. Everybody remembers him, obviously, as being a musician. But really, at heart, he was always a writer and a poet.
At heart, Leonard Cohen was always a poet. Yeah. I think, basically, he just realized. By the way, his voice sucked. That's one thing he told me in Montreal. My voice sucks. And he says, I'm going to go for lessons just to learn how to keep my voice at a certain level and mumble it off and make hopefully enough that people can appreciate the poetry there. The bottom line is that's exactly what he did. His voice always sucked. He kept a low profile with the tunes and the vocals and whatever, and he had such an appreciation of imagery and poetry that it just came across in a beautiful way.
I mean, it's probably the first time we've ever introduced a song on the radio by saying, here's a song by a singer who sucks. But here we are with Leonard Cohen's So Long, Marianne.
Come over to the window, my little darling. I'd like to try to read your palm. I used to think I was some kind of gypsy boy before I let you take me home. Now so long, Marianne, it's time we began to lie and cry and cry and laugh about it all. Well, you know that I love to live with you, but you make me forget so very much. I forget to pray for the angels, and then the angels forget to pray for us. Ah, so long, Marianne, it's time we began to laugh and cry and cry and laugh about it all again. We met when we were almost young, deep in the green lilac park. You held on to me like I was a crucifix as we went kneeling through the dark. Oh, so long, Marianne, time we began to laugh and cry and cry and laugh about it all again. Your letters, they all say that you're beside me now. Then why do I feel alone? I'm standing on a ledge and you're fine. Spider web is fastening my ankle to a stone. Now so long, Marianne, it's time that we began to laugh and cry and cry and laugh about it all. Your hidden love, I'm cold as a new razor blade. You left when I told you I was curious. I never said that I was brave. Oh, so long, and cry and laugh about it all. Oh, you are really such a pretty one. I see you've gone and changed your name again. And just when I climb this whole mountainside to wash my eyelids in the rain, oh, so long, Marianne,
Hey, welcome back to Word Perfect. You're listening to Siren Radio. My name's Steve Court, and we're joined today in the studio by Michael Lee Johnson from Illinois over in the United States. Before the break there, we were talking about interesting things. He met the singer who was just on there when you're listening to Leonard Cohen. He's had an incredible life, having to change countries, move around, do all these fantastic things. But what I want to talk to you about now, Michael, is your life as a writer today, because you're involved in so many things, aren't you?
Oh, I'm so involved. I think I'm about ready to sink.
So you edit a lot of online websites and sort of Facebook groups and things like that, don't you? So how did you get involved in that?
Well, you know, as selfish as a person, I guess many people probably think I am. And since I don't have any family left, I guess I am a selfish person, because I'm self-interested in a sense that I only have myself to care about. I started several poetry sites for submissions for other poets as a basic concern and an outlet. I don't think people have any understanding how difficult it is to be a publisher, even on a free website or a paid website, .com or whatever. The reality is every website has different formats, different fonts, different this, that, and the other. It becomes very difficult to keep up with all the changes on formatting from one website to another, one whatever to another. I had 10 at one time, but I just became overwhelmed with it. I did my best for 3, 4, 5 years with it. But as I became more involved in my videos, my own poetry, actually my own poetry is sort of actually in the background. We'll talk about that later, hopefully ask me about that. But the truth of the matter is the Facebook sites, the poetry Facebook sites I have right now are just, they're very time consuming. But I've learned that, you know what, if you can't help others, if you don't help promote others, if you don't promote yourself, who cares and who the hell will?
No, I 100% agree. It's one of the big struggles I have is I spend so much time now editing other people's work that I don't probably get as much time to write or do things for myself as I would like. And yet the reason I got into these things was because I was a writer and a performer myself.
You know what? That what you're saying right now probably is the key to the whole interview. You know, somewhere, if you're this way, and if people on your sites and in your life believe that you have helped them someplace along the way, it's a Jesus thing. It's a spiritual thing. It's a whatever you want to call it, attachment thing. But if you don't help other people, even though it takes your life away and maybe even affects your family or whatever, the bottom line is if you can't help other people, you're never going to leave a legacy. But I'll tell you what, being on the back burner really burns and hurts.
Yeah, it does. It really does, doesn't it? It's a hard thing. It's a hard thing to, because I'm in that same position as you with, obviously, with the magazine and editing and things like that. I love the fact that I'm providing a platform for other people. I love the fact that I'm giving people who haven't been published the opportunity to do those things and to, you know, to get their work out there and do that. But it is coming at the sacrifice of my own creativity, because I'm spending my time designing a cover for them rather than designing a cover for me, or helping to provide a platform for their work to go on. But actually, and I feel slightly awkward about putting any of my own work onto the website.
I wouldn't do that, Steve. You know, I don't know exactly how to say it, but you know, as caring as you can be, the reality is you have to promote yourself too, because if you remember in my previous comment, it's just not a bad matter about caring about everybody else. I said, if we don't promote ourselves, I'm going to revise it a bit. If we don't promote ourselves, who the hell else is going to? Especially in poetry.
Yeah, it is a very niche world. But I think that the world of writers in general is quite an isolated place, isn't it? You sit alone, your thoughts are your own, you write your own thing. There's very few writers that write as a partnership or as a pair. It is a very,
very, very, very seldom. I'd have to think about it. I can't think of one. Oh, yes, I can. Carl Sandburg and his wife. I don't think she wrote, but she was in total collaboration with him. When he went to work, she typed his poetry up, she sent him up, but that's unusual.
I mean, Carl Sandburg is a huge influence on American writers for a long time. I mean, a lot of his work was kind of 1916, or some of his prime work was around that time, wasn't it? So we're talking about someone who's been in the public domain for a long time. But I think I can't remember which president it was that said, please don't expect me to remember that because I'm not that good on my American presidents. But said something along the lines of Sandberg being more than just the voice of America, that he was America.
Well, he also wrote an infamous, spent 10 years actually writing the history or the dialogues to whatever of Abraham Lincoln, which is probably his most memorable thing. But I remember Carl Sandburg, I loved him because one, he was simple, down to earth. He created images that I could understand. I could read them and sit back with a cup of coffee and just say, yeah, I like that.
Yeah, it's very easy to read. And I think he's still very easy to read now, which is testament to someone who can have written, you know, when some of his work is as old as it is, that it still stands up today.
Yeah, see, he was no T.S. Eliot, but who cares about that?
But sometimes simple is more effective.
I think simple is the best because the reality is, and don't get me wrong, I'm always, you know, oh, the grammar boy that was flunked in high school, you know, that can't spell and pronounce because I missed 3 years or 4 years from grade one to four because I had a disease, cancer in my bones and both my legs had to be carried around here and there. Bottom line is I missed grammar, I missed syntax, I missed all those things. He's in grade one to four. I spent the rest of my life trying to make up for that.
Wow. It's a shame today that I'm going to, at some point, I will have to end our conversation because we'll simply run out of time. But I think I could talk to you. You've got so many interesting things we could talk about. But so what was your first kind of break as a writer? When was it that you realized this was something you were going to pursue properly?
I don't know if there was one thing, but I would have to say an isolation and desolation and a sense of being out there someplace and not knowing where I am. You know, there was sort of a Jesus in my life and I have a hope and I have a belief. And I also feel that I want to leave some type of a legacy, no matter how small, if this earth still survives after I'm gone, behind. That's my dream. That's my hope. That's who I am.
Well, I think the amount of the work that you've shared and the amount of people that you've helped and that you helped to promote, that's 100% going to be a thing, isn't it? You've touched a lot of different writers' lives. You were saying to me earlier, I mean, how many people roughly do you think you are connected to? How many writers do you think you're connected to through your various sites?
You know what? I just got through. I'm going to see if I can pull it up over here. Got a publication today. I bought Globe Magazine. She's an Indian writer out of India. I opened it up. It's February 2020. Anyway, inside here is 152 pages. Out of these 152 pages, at least 55, 60 poets, at least 35 to 45 of them were in my poetry groups on Facebook poetry groups.
That's a pretty good return rate, isn't it?
Oh, it's huge.
But it's good. But I know we're talking big numbers, aren't we, on your poetry sites? They're, you know, in the sort of the tens of thousands of
active. Well, it all sounds good at 34,000, but, you know, there's a lot of overlaps, in honesty, Steve, from, you know, contemporary poets to poets global to, you know, audio. I also have a site just for video and SoundCloud. I mean, YouTube and SoundCloud. But when you really factor it all in, there's 34,000 people. They all go from one site to another, a lot of them. So, round it off, 14,900, give or take.
Incredible. I mean, still, it's a huge reach, isn't it? So, but of all the publications you've been involved with, of all of the places you've been published yourself, do you still remember the first time you were accepted somewhere?
Absolutely. I was in Canada, Vietnam War, and there was a small magazine while I was up there. Steve, this is beyond you, because come on, let's be honest, you're too damn young for me, all right? you know, I can't help your ways, pretty. Look, the bottom line is, when I was in Canada, Steve, this is back in the old days when you had a damn finger-type typewriter. If you're lucky, you had an electric typewriter. You were ripping pages out. You were throwing them on the ground. You were grabbing envelopes. You were putting stamps extra to get your return of your poems back, international coupons, on and on and on, and no editor ever responded to you. I do. I had a stupid ass poem I thought was just the worst thing I'd ever written. It was some poem about the Vietnam War, and there was, at that time, years ago, probably about 1972 or so, AIM magazine, AIM, A-I-M magazine, in Chicago, Illinois, ironically, and I'm living in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. And I sent a stupid little poem, had about 7 or 8 lines or 10 on it or whatever, stand straight, the pine tree, whatever, you know, your will and your strength and whatever. And I had no, but you know what? It happened to fit their profile, their theme, their, you know, protests of the Vietnam War. And they published it. And I go, what the hell is this? It's the worst poem I've written so far, and it's published, you know? And they're, of course, they're extinct now, you know what I mean? But yes, I remember very clearly. You're lucky if you ever got a response from anybody. They didn't want photocopies, but yet they would send you photocopy rejections. They didn't, you know, they very seldom ever made comments to you. And if you got a few comments, you better listen, you know? And it cost a lot of money back then because you're typing up one by one, 5 poems separately, folding them, of course, ripping out the papers and starting all over. We won't go into that. You put them in an envelope and you put 5 more in there so they can send it back to you, and have them don't. And you're wondering, what the hell am I doing? Nobody's paying for me this for this anyway. Actually, my first publication was a poem about being in exile to a couple of publications in Canada that had to do with, you know, something to the effect being a Vietnam War resistor, the price it was paid, a price that continues to be paid. But it's another story.
I mean, it is a different world, isn't it? I mean, I've got to admit, for someone of my age, it's always been an email submission, pretty much. There's been very, very few times I've ever had to post anything anywhere. That's even more commitment when you think of it like that, the effort it would physically take to put a submission in. It's not as easy as just flicking the laptop on and hitting send.
Absolutely. There's a plus and a minus to that. The plus side is you can get exposed to a lot and find and search many other publishers and editors that you have an opportunity with. And that has certainly blossomed and helped me. The downside of it is it also becomes polluted, and there's so many places to go and so many things to do that it just becomes overwhelming a bit. I don't know. You know, Carl Sandburg back in the day, and other people even worse back, you know, even Edgar Allan Poe or whoever, you know, they had to do the old thing, you know, I don't know, handwrite it, put an envelope, stamp it, and 6 weeks later gets to somebody and they hope to get published. It took Carl Sandburg, if I remember correctly, he had some, I don't know if you're familiar with poetry. In Chicago, Illinois. It's the number one poetry publication probably in the world. All right. Bottom line is it took Carl Sandburg about 110 times sending there by his wife to get one poem published. And it was that poem I sent you. The one about the little cat, Fog.
Which, you know, when you look at somebody who had the career and the reputation that he had, it just shows you how hard it can be sometimes to get into publications. And I think that's still probably as relevant today, because it's these publications tend to be run by editors. I mean, you're one, I'm one. It's a very, very subjective world. What you like, I'm not with, and vice versa. And so for writers, it's sometimes a hard process to know where to go and who's the right fit for the work that they're producing.
Yes, and sometimes I've learned something, because now, at this point, I'm glad you brought that up. Now I'm a poet, I'm an editor, I'm a publisher. And I do mass send out my poetry to several publications at the same time. And every once in a while, one of them gets at me and says, we don't accept blah, 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 and previously published poems and all this kind of stuff. And then, of course, I respond, because that 15% rebel in me still says, yeah, that means to me you're more concerned about your damn guidelines than you are about the quality of the work being sent to you. And we could go on forever about that.
Yeah, you see, with Inspired, I don't have an issue in publishing previously published work. I like to be able to acknowledge that it has been published somewhere else or to acknowledge that publication, but I don't have a problem. I see it a little bit like if I went to see my favorite band, I would like to hear them play their best songs than just play a song because nobody's heard it before. And so I feel a bit like that with poetry. I'd rather read something, like if you're submitting to our magazine, I'd rather read your best writing than not read your best writing because 8 years ago it appeared in another magazine somewhere else.
I totally agree with you. And I'm going to be honest with you, you know, if you're Mick Jagger and it's the Rolling Stones, it's been played everywhere. And okay, I'm sorry, but I've heard that a million times. But in poetry, come on, let's be real here. You know, because of all the bad experiences, so many of us in the United States and maybe elsewhere in the world have experienced. In high school, we got taught, you know, Lord Byron and this and Shakespeare. And it was just nobody. It turned people off on poetry. So nowadays, you know, even with contemporary poets, and I think I have some of the finest poets on my Facebook poetry groups right now. I honestly feel that stigma affected so many people. We're lucky if we have somewhere between 6 and 10% of the population that even wants to listen or hear about poetry.
Absolutely. I've been fighting that argument for a long time, that and especially when you look at what it is. So we put a 12-year-old child in school in front of a piece of writing written 400 years ago by somebody about the loss of the love of their life. And I think you're asking a child to access two things that are impossible: writing that's so old and antiquated that it just doesn't relate to them, and you're asking them to understand an emotion and experience that they can never ever possibly have gone through.
Yes, because so, it was a different time and place. And it's not that you're being disrespectful, you're just too young to understand that.
Absolutely. But what you reflect on as that child is, you reflect on it as poetry, not as a piece of writing. And so you just go, I now hate all poetry because of that.
And now I sort of apologize, because I actually go back now and I look up these people. I look up their histories. I look up their bios, and I want to understand their, you know, their background and where they came from, because I'm more mature now. But you shoved that damn line, I mean, the Byron stuff down my throat, and how a tree is and whatever at 8 years old. It turned me off for a long, long, long time. And I, you know, I guess only between turmoil and upset and emotional screw ups that most poets have at one time or another in their life, depression, etc. The bottom line is, that's it.
No, I think that's true. Shakespeare gets forced upon school children over and over and over again, to the point where they just become, they loathe even the sound of hearing his name. Whereas, and I was one of those kids, yet now, if I could pick three plays that I want to be in more than anything in the world, all three of them would be a Shakespeare play, because now I can appreciate it, I can understand it, I can see it for what it is. But I think poetry has had that beaten with sticks approach on so many people that they've just switched off to it. And so you're right, we have got to change the way that we get people to access and to understand and to relate to what's being written.
How much time we got? We got at least 30 seconds or so?
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Interview, Steve. I can't pronounce your last name, C-A-W-T. What the hell is
court,
that?
Like tennis court, but spelt different.
What? How do you pronounce it?
Court, like a tennis court.
Oh, yeah, I don't believe that. But anyway, what do you call a person from Lincolnshire? A belly? I mean, a yellow belly or a yeller belly?
A yellow belly.
The uniforms of the old Lincolnshire regiments were green with yellow faces. I have to comment on your lovely wife and family. Saw your little girl holding a mic, following daddy's footprints for sure.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, my kids are, they're kind of a split of myself. So my son is a fantastic writer, absolutely incredible writer, but he has no interest in going on the stage. Whereas my daughter just wants to sing, to dance, to act. That's all she's about.
You have a wonderful family. You know, and guess what? I had three marriages and they're all gone for God knows how long. I had three marriages and I've been single since, what, 1978. So, you know, I saw when I looked and reviewed your history, because I feel it's sort of important if you're going to do an interview with somebody, you spend a little bit of time trying to understand the interviewer, a little bit about their history so that you can communicate maybe in a more effective manner.
It's good to know you've checked out who's going to be asking the questions. It's shows a bit of diligence on your behalf, doesn't it?
Oh, you got a great looking family, I'm telling you.
I do. I'm a very, very lucky man. Very lucky man.
Very lucky.
And when you see my face, given that I've got a face for radio, how I've ended up with them, I have no idea.
You know what, Steve? You know what? I was looking at your wife and you together and the children together in a you know, in a consummated picture or whatever. And you're saying you're so short, man. You're a good looking man. You know, the only difference is I'm 73 and you're whatever the hell, 45, 43, whatever. You know, but the bottom line is your kids look like you. They look like her. I mean, you know, it's a wonderful world. You know what? In our everyday life, when we're naked and we have all of our daily, going to the bathrooms and whatever, and et cetera, we don't think so much of ourselves. But you know what? You have a wonderful, wonderful looking family.
Hey, unfortunately, it does bring us to the end of today's show. We are running shy of time. So I just need to get my last few questions in for you, Michael. So what's next? Is there anything new planned or is it a case of continuing with all the bits you've currently got going?
It's simple. Steve, I and I think you can relate to this. I have over 500 published poems. Over 2,1300 different publications at this point. But between the groups, the poetry sites, the Facebook things and so forth. The reality is I've totally ignored my own work. I've been trying to organize into chat books, 30, 40 poems at a time. And then maybe hopefully at the end of all that, drawing them together into collective works like Carl Sandburg did. But I got to be honest. Whew. And you know what? God forbid, I paid $139 a year for Grammarly. So now I get to go through every single one of those poems and make corrections. Not that I have to follow Grammarly in every simple way, because fragments are allowed in poetry. We do have some license there. But the reality is I have to go through them all and figure it out. What theme are they going to go into? What chat book? Then once I get those chat books, you know, life in exile, love poems. Themes, bring them all together into one collection after I do the chapbook. I can't get there. I just haven't had enough time. I'm getting old. I'm 73.
Well, that's it sounds like you've got a challenge on your hands if you're going to get that done. That's
you
a lot of work to work through for anybody. And as an editor, how do you find the time? Because I'll be honest, I run one site and one magazine, and that is now becoming an all-consuming life thing. And yet you're doing that for several of these. So where do you find extra hours in the day?
I don't. But the bottom line is that I still run a business, Steve, at 73. I run a promotional imprinted apparel products business at 73 part-time. I need to make that because I don't make a whole lot of my Social Security make ends meet. But fortunately, I was involved in mutual funds for 30 years and it's helped. Get back to your question. I don't. I start at 12 o'clock midnight after I've done all my things with my groups. I woke up, whatever. And I start working on my own work at midnight. And even then I'm getting messages from the groups. Can you show my book on the groups? Can you? And you know what? I love that. I love it. I'm not complaining about it. But you know, I have to shut it off because after midnight, I have to work on my own videos, my own poetry. On my cassette tapes, forgive me, on my little, little mini cassette tapes, recorders. Guess what? They don't exist anymore. But I've got so much stuff to do, you wouldn't believe it. So I end up with 3-4 hours sleep. And then I just cancel out the next day and maybe go sleep for 12 hours. It's the only thing I can do.
Yeah, I can share that. The working at midnight and the still being there at 5 a.m. is definitely something that I'm seeing at the moment. But we do, unfortunately, have to limit our chat because of the clock rather than because of interest. So I think you're someone I will be in contact with again in the future, Michael, and we'll have to do this again and maybe delve into some more of these things in a little bit more detail. But thank you very much for joining us for a conversation today.
I would like to also comment real quickly, Steve, that I've received many comments about you and how kind and how thoughtful and caring you are as a person. I just want to put that in.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. We're going to play out now for the rest of for the end of today's show. But if you've enjoyed listening to Word Perfect here on Siren Radio, then please do join us again. We're on at 4 o'clock on a Monday, repeated again at 1 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon. And you can always find us at any time of your choosing on the podcast site. So come along and find us. See what we've got going on and get yourself acquainted with some of the many, many incredible writers around the world. So this is us playing out on WordPerfect. Thank you for listening. This is now Simon and Garfunkel, The Boxer.
Just a poor boy, though my story is seldom told. I squandered my resistance for a pocket full of mumbles, such are promises. All lies and jest, still the man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest. My home and my family, I was no more than a boy in the company of strangers, in the quiet of the railway station, when I'm scared. Laying low, seeking out the poor quarters where the ragged people go, looking for the places only they would know. La-la-la, la-la-la-la, asking only workmen's wages, I come looking for a job, but I get no offers. Just to come home from the wars on 7th Avenue. I do declare there were times when I was so lonesome I took some comfort there. La 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 la. Shame, I am leaving, but the fight is still.